This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Activist Kathy Kelly has been around the world in support of peace. On the Gaza Strip, she lived among Palestinians during a time when bombs fell every 11 minutes. She was in Iraq for the shock and awe bombardment at the start of the 2003 invasion. And she's been to Afghanistan many times, learning how Afghani civilians suffer and survive amidst the war. She concluded her most recent trip in April. She was working with young Afghanis who want to stop the killing in their country. These are some of the activities that have led her to three nominations for the Nobel Peace Prize. Kathy Kelly speaks tonight at the Unitarian Universalist Community Church in Chapel Hill, but first she is in our studio. Kathy Kelly, welcome. So good to have you here.
Thank you, Frank. It's good to be on the State of Things.
Tell us about your recent trip to Afghanistan. What have you been doing over there?
Well, the last trip in March and April involved 28 people from the United States, and mostly we were witnesses to some extraordinary young people. You know, in Afghanistan, 65% of the people in the country are under 25 years of age. High risk for the youngsters in Afghanistan for many reasons. 850 children die every day from malnutrition, from, you know, the consequences of poverty, gastrointestinal disease. But the Afghan Youth Peace Volunteers come from the Central Highlands, the province of Bamyan, and they went to Kabul and held something very unusual, a walk, an inter-ethnic walk. And they wore sky blue scarves and white outfits, and they walked together for blocks leading up to the UN. And in spite of the fact that riot police had come and that they could go on somebody's list, and they actually have paid a price since, and the next day they planted 55 trees in one of the grade schools and symbols of their durable commitment to peacemaking. And then they lit candles that night, a candlelight vigil, commemorating, among others, the 9 children in the Kunar province who'd been out doing what they often do, collecting firewood on a mountainside. And they were gunned down by a helicopter gunship, a U.S. helicopter gunship, executed. And this was not so unusual. In that same province, a nearby mountainside, 6 children out scavenging for metal, hoping they'd find landmines, actually, were killed by a U.S. helicopter gunship. And the children, the youngsters from the Afghan Youth Peace Volunteers took us to the Chadahi Kambar refugee camp in a previous trip of mine. And we met with families, 1,000 families displaced by the war. And one family was led by a man who had actually lost 5 children and his wife from a drone attack, a United States drone attack. I remember sitting next to little Jumagul, and her uncle unzipped her jacket. It was such a cold day, I'd kind of huddled next to her for warmth, and he showed me where her arm should have been, and she had been also attacked by this drone.
We're told here in the United States that life under the Taliban was miserable. It was a repressive regime. The United States is freeing the Afghanis from that. Is there support for that kind of activity and freedom from what we are told was Taliban repression?
You know, many people don't believe the elections in Afghanistan were democratic. They believe they were fraudulent. So then I think you have to turn to polls if you're going to try to get some assessment. What do people in Afghanistan want? It's interesting. The polls show that about 90% of the population fears and hates the Taliban. I think we could safely say that they don't want their future to be dictated by their invaders and occupiers, or by those who've invaded and occupied cutting deals with the Taliban. So there's a great deal of anxiety, which often translates into violence in many parts of Afghanistan today. It's not a situation that at all lends to cartoonized foreign policy issues. But I think that one of the things we could consider is that security is not only the security felt because the side that you're on has a bigger gun than the other side. There's food security, health security, education security. And people crave that all throughout Afghanistan. People want that for their children. And meanwhile, we're spending $2 billion per week, some of it which goes right into the hands of Taliban and other warlords controlling the roadways so that the United States can bring in thousands of trucks every week to supply U.S. soldiers with food and with water, surely. But, you know, each U.S. soldier consumes on average 22 gallons of fuel per day. I know that sounds crazy, but it's the Congressional Research Information Service statistic.
So when there's a peace movement, when there is something like political activism around peace in a place like Afghanistan, How does it work? I mean, we imagine how a peace movement would work in this country to activate a political movement and affect the vote. People change the way they vote. You're out of Vietnam. You're out of Iraq. But what about in Afghanistan? How does it work? Where's the pressure?
Mm-hmm. Well, let me just say that 3% of people in Afghanistan have access to the internet. And probably 90% of them are United States military and military contractors. So they really have to rely on different resources. Cell phones become quite important. People do get news, but I'd have to say that in small villages, there are 10,000 villages in Afghanistan. People that I asked, did they have any idea of what 9/11 was all about, had no idea. So it's difficult to do organizing. And yet, much as you can imagine the vigils that happen for peace here in Raleigh and in other parts in Durham, throughout the Triangle, when people do go out on the streets and assert themselves, this is newsworthy because it just doesn't happen all that often. So we found that the Afghan Youth Peace Volunteers have become top of the line news on the TV stations and in some of the papers.
But does that add up to pressure to get the United States out, or does it mean creating alternative structures to provide education and food security and the things that the Americans are not?
Well, I would encourage your listeners to go to their website and read the December Review, the People's Alternative December Review, which these youngsters created. And they had listened to people from 29 different NGOs. They didn't interview all of them, but they looked for the ones who'd signed on to a paper calling for the U.S. troops to stop the death squads, the night raids, the assassinations, the aerial bombardments, and the drone bombardments. And they wanted to challenge President Obama and say, you know, your review gave a pretty rosy picture of a situation that is not looking rosy to us. And they're very aware of how much resource goes into maintaining the occupation.
That's an interesting document. Not a lot of attention has been called to that.
The Nowhere to Turn report, right?
29 NGOs have said that this is not creating security at all. And the American presence is making things worse.
Yeah, thanks, Frank. And they deliberately delivered it to the NATO conference on November 19th in Lisbon, Spain, when NATO was exultant because the Asia Development Bank said, okay, we'll bankroll, we'll finance the TAPI pipeline, Turkmenistan, Afghanistan, Pakistan, India pipeline. Maybe that pipeline has something to do with why we have 200 forward operating bases and 3 major bases and such an investment in keeping troops in Afghanistan until 2014, because that's the date when the pipeline is supposed to be finished.
One aspect of Afghanistan and the situation there that I don't think we do realize or would consider as a problem is air quality, which is tell us about that.
Well, unfortunately, the worst air quality in the world is in Afghanistan's capital city of Kabul, which was built for 500,000. And then there were 1 million people. And now there are 5 million with so many refugees having poured in. And they've never been able to get an adequate sewage and sanitation infrastructure. So the city has the highest content of fecal matter in its air of anywhere in the world. 3,000 people die every year in Kabul alone just because of the horrible air. When you get beyond Kabul, it's quite a beautiful countryside, except that the mountains have been denuded of trees because of warfare and because of impoverishment.
How does Afghanistan compare to some of the other areas you visited? We talked about you've been to Bosnia, you've been to certainly to Gaza and in Iraq. How does Afghanistan compare?
Well, I would say similar to Gaza, many people feel very trapped in Afghanistan. They simply have nowhere to turn and nowhere to go. I have to say the most wretched, squalid refugee camp I've ever been in was the Sachadhi Kambar refugee camp in Afghanistan. And the prospects are very grim for young people, you know, with a life expectancy of 42 years of age, 1 out of 5 not living beyond the age of 5. And the education is so rife with corruption that it's hard to see how this new generation, idealistic as many may be and craving a better life, how will they get ahead? But, you know, when I think of the $2 billion per week we're spending on the war, those resources could be spent very differently.
We're very used to the idea of political activism in this country and in the West. In Afghanistan, we're given to believe that patience is the primary virtue, that they've seen armies come and they've seen them go, and here's yet another set of wanderers who are on their way out. Is that an impediment to organizing? Do people say there's no sense in fighting this? We'll just wait until the Americans wear themselves out and go.
It's a very difficult question to answer. I think there quite likely is some underground organizing that I can't be aware of, because it is underground. And I think that it's more likely that people are feeling high and acute frustration. There's a Pakistani journalist who once said that hunger and anger combined are like combining two live wires. It creates an incandescent flash and it can't always be controlled. I would say anticipate that more so than abiding patience.
We're going to continue our conversation with Kathy Kelly, a Nobel Prize nominee. She's going to be at the Unitarian Universalist Community Church of Chapel Hill tonight at 7:30, talking about the cost of war and the price of peace. Just ahead, our conversation with Kathy Kelly continues. We'll talk about other women activists and their role in a very changing world. Talk about that on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Nonviolent political action has a long and successful history. It did throughout the entire 20th century. Names like Martin Luther King Jr. and Mohandas Gandhi come to mind. But the women who were essential to the civil rights, peace, and other movements were often overlooked. We want to shed some light on the role of women activists in the 20th century and beyond. Kathy Kelly is with us. She's an activist, author, and three-time Nobel Peace Prize nominee. She's recently back from Afghanistan, where she's working with Afghani youth. Also joining us now in the studio is Blair Kelly. She's an associate professor of history at North Carolina State University and author of Right to Ride, Streetcar Boycotts and African-American Citizenship in the Era of Plessy versus Ferguson. Welcome back, Blair. Good to have you here.
Great to be here again.
Also on the phone with us, Frances Hasso, an associate professor in women's studies and international comparative studies at Duke University. Welcome, Frances.
Thank you.
Blair, let's start with you. The civil rights movement, we certainly know Martin Luther King's name and we know many of the other men. Tell us about what women were doing back in that movement.
They were doing the same kinds of things, and they were also the resonance with hearing about her, Ms. Kelly's work in Afghanistan is amazing, because she's talking about what families need and what people want for their children and the overall quality of life, and that being the larger concern, not just sort of thinking about basic security, but long-term security, making sure that there is food and health care and education, and that those are also the important things. And so it had an incredible resonance with thinking about the Black women activists that I study at the turn of the 20th century and the ones I teach about in the civil rights movement, who were concerned about the same things, that segregation was not only sort of a problem confronting sort of the material aspects of everyday life, but about the ability of people to think about their futures.
And that played out, as you said, at the beginning, at the turn of the century, when women were part of a movement keeping churches together, schools together, organizations that provided the foundation for the movement that emerged and blossomed in the 60s, but was going much, much earlier than that.
That there really was no generation of men or women who accepted second-class citizenship or some bizarre notion of who they were as American citizens, that women were at the heart of that and spoke up even when it was considered quite controversial for them to do so.
Frances Hasso, you have been following the revolution spreading across North Africa and the Middle East. What role, tell us about the role that women have been playing in those various countries.
I mean, women have really been active on a range of levels, from mobilizing before the revolutions to being on the streets, being involved in logistics, organizing people, articulating positions, and strategizing. There's pretty much no level of these revolutions where women have not been involved. So I would say it's very, very widespread. And I would include girls as well as women.
You know, media and technology have played a role in all of these movements. And Blair, if we go back to the civil rights movement, that's when television news was coming of age. How much did that have to do with the fact that men were taking the leading roles in the civil rights movement?
I think it misshapes our memory of the movement. It helps us forget people like Ella Baker and Septima Clark, who were just as formidable and central to the theorizing of civil rights as people like Martin Luther King. And so we tend to remember the images that were projected and then that are preserved over time, which are wonderful. You know, as a person who works on things before we had film, recording those movements, I treasure them. But it also creates a very narrow narrative of the biggest spokesperson being the person that we assume is doing all the organizing. But organizing really happens away from a podium. And women were at the heart of doing that kind of work.
But was there a sense among the organizers, too, that they didn't want women necessarily in those positions, that they didn't want them seen as the spokespeople for this movement?
I think there, you know, in the Black community at the time, there was a sense that you wanted to give African-American men the opportunity to be the spokespeople because they were in a diminished position in the larger society. And so that it in part was important for the gendering of Black men to allow them to speak. So at the March on Washington, you have a moment where the women are on stage and are applauded and then told to stand and then sit back down and they're not allowed to speak. So it's amazing that you have women who were unconcerned with whether or not people knew their names or heard their voices, but were primarily concerned with this movement work going on over time.
Frances, I would guess that things are different from country to country, are they not, when it comes to women's roles now in the revolutions going on in North Africa?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, they're different in terms of the histories that have existed and the participation and activism of women in previous times in different movements, anti-colonial, nationalist movements, and democracy movements. But I would also say that there's a kind of emergent politics that we might call a bit viral in the sense that girls and women are so active at so many levels in some of these countries, and it really, and then women and girls in other countries are seeing and watching that there's a way that the history really matters in terms of what's possible. And then in another way, there are some really radical transformations in spaces where it's pretty unusual for women to take that kind of very high-profile political role.
Give us an example of that.
Well, I can think of, I mean, I think of a couple of examples. For example, Esma Mahfouz, who is the Egyptian young woman, the video blogger, who mobilized before the January 25th revolution. Her video blog went viral in Egypt, where she was encouraging everyone to go out and not to be afraid. And she's from quite a modest background, actually. So in one way, that's a very important role, and it's highly, I mean, she played a very important role in that particular mobilization and is acknowledged and recognized. In Egypt, however, there is a history of women being involved, middle-class women, educated women, in a variety of movements for the past 100 years. If you compare that, for example, with Yemen, where there's a young woman journalist named Afrah Nasser, who has been very, very important, both in terms of what's going on in Change Square in Yemen as an organizer, activist, and also communicator and translator, but also as somebody who communicates with people outside of Yemen in both Arabic and English. And in Yemen, I mean, at least the Yemen of the last 10 or 20 years, it's even difficult for women to sort of mix with men on the streets and demonstrations, whereas that's much more common, for example, in the context of Egypt. But in the current revolution, women and men are mixing on the streets in the context of these anti-government and democracy demonstrations, and they're helping to articulate the demands of the youth revolution, and also producing poetry and art and those kinds of things that are very important in what's happening in Yemen, meaning the revolutions are occurring on multiple dimensions, and women are having a much higher profile than they've had in the past.
Kathy Kelly, have you seen a change in the way women participate in political activities, political action over the course of your career?
Well, I think that it's very, very important to have the kind of research that our guests today have been engaging in, both to understand the limitations but also the challenges. It seems to me that the sensitivity toward the suffering that women bear in undue and exacerbated proportions, women and children, during times of war, has been raised, but the corollary to that is that there are more women and children being killed in all of these multiple wars. I think it's hard to know what the impact of internet and globalized internet might be for a future generation, but it's crucial that those who can raise their voices, I mean, let's face it, here in the United States, we have an ability to exercise our First Amendment right to free speech, much more so than the women in that Frances has been mentioning, or young women that I know in Afghanistan. And yet they directly bear the results of the fact that we're the chief exporters of armaments in all the world. So we here in the United States have, a huge responsibility to speak. I was so surprised to hear young Afghan youth peace volunteers quoting segments from the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King's speeches. They've memorized them. And yet I realize now, listening to you, Blair, that my job is to help them get familiar with Ella Baker. Right. So there's more work to do.
Well, and it is interesting to think of a feminist movement that grew out of the civil rights movement that became the platform for allowing women to become more visible as spokespeople for a movement. That really was kind of the order of operations in our peace and civil liberties movement here, civil justice.
Yes, and it's really interesting because it's the order in the anti-slavery movement as well. And it's incredible when you start thinking about the importance of citizenship and defining it and defining rights. Immediately, the questions of broader rights come to the fore of the people in the room, and they're all concerned with making sure that they think broadly about women, about children, about gender, about sexuality, because all of a sudden you're blowing out the expectations of what should and could and can happen for everyone.
And now you have Alice Walker, author of The Color Purple, being probably the most prominent person on the USA boat to Gaza that will leave later this month. I mean, she's utterly expansive in her compassion. There aren't borders.
Yes, and she's a movement person. She starts out in the civil rights movement in Mississippi and grows in that same model of many of the women that I study who are always looking for the next movement in much the same way that your career has taught us.
Frances Hasso, what about the American model, if we can call it that, of political action? To what extent does that play a part in what's happening now in the Arab and Muslim world?
I think where we are at right now in these Arab Spring revolts, it depends on, there are different stages in different countries. I think that people, in the countries where the revolts have been successful to a degree, you are facing a kind of classic problem that has been faced by women, for example, in the United States and in many other countries, which is whether the kind of participation and activism and organizing and strategizing where women were included, you know, the role of women in that strategizing, whether it would translate into actual institutionalized power, whether women would be represented in the forms that emerge from these revolts and revolutions. And it's been a mixed kind of record when you look at revolutions and revolts historically in terms of the degree to which women become involved after those revolts. And my research, not necessarily on the Arab Springs because they're very young, but on previous kinds of movements and revolutions in the region, is that the more militarized they are, the less likely, actually, that outcomes are inclusive, not only of women, but of a whole range of subordinated groups in a society, meaning the less this are the more, for lack of a better term, peaceful or nonviolent the processes are, the more likely more people are involved. Because obviously most men don't become militarized either in revolutions, but still militarization tends to primarily value men, and men are primarily involved in those kinds of processes. So I think that's really the big issue, what's being struggled with in Egypt, for example, and in Tunisia, in terms of what will happen with the Egyptian constitution, what will courts look like, what will family law look like, why is the transitional governing council dominated by men, I mean, with maybe a symbolic representation of, you know, a woman who wasn't necessarily highly active in the revolution? Or what does it mean that Egyptian women activists were subjected to virginity tests last month because of their involvement in the revolutionary movements by the ruling military council? I mean, so we're definitely still in this transitional moment, but what you also see is high awareness among activists and youth movements that these are issues that must continually be struggled around, and that there's a recognition that it really takes work to institutionalize and transform a society beyond the initial sort of political revolution.
Well, let me ask you a question that I think springs from that, Kathy Kelly. Do you see tension in Afghanistan among the groups that you work with between men and women in a society where women have been historically in subordinate positions?
To be honest, I wouldn't identify the tension so much as between men and women as more of a generational tension, both men and women in an older generation saying to the young Afghan youth peace volunteers, you're naive, you're too young, you don't understand. And I was so impressed. I mean, at one point, one of the boys spoke up and said, well, my father was killed by the Taliban. I do understand. And it was a woman who was speaking to him, and she was a bit flabbergasted because just speaking up to somebody in an older generation is not done. So I see people taking risks in part because they don't see a whole lot of other options other than to speak up. And I know the sisters of these young boys, and really the people who gave us hospitality in Kabul, were very brave women, one of whom is under a death threat, and she's like 18 years old. So I guess I when Francis mentioned the Arab Spring, I'm hoping for the American autumn. Mm-hmm. That, you know, we here can start to take our responsibility. And October will mark the 10th year now of this warfare in Afghanistan. And some people have already forgotten that the war is even going on. Mm-hmm. So I hope we can listen to younger counterparts, both young men and young women in places like Afghanistan and Iraq and Gaza, and take on our roles. October 6th will be an important day in Washington, D.C., when many people plan to gather. And veterans from the war in Afghanistan will bike there from New York City, leaving on September 11th from Ground Zero.
Well, when you think about something Francis said, which is that a nonviolent movement that takes a look at some of the broader issues that Blair raised, food security, education, some of those fundamental human rights that are denied even to people in this country. Is there a way that this is a kind of a globalized movement, that what we're not talking about, Afghanistan or Egypt or Tunisia, that people who are hurt by the cost of the war, small towns that have been enormously costly in terms of blood and treasure to those towns in this country, have something very much in common with what's going on in Afghanistan and Egypt?
Well, we can add Barcelona and Madrid and Mexico. I mean, there are so many places where people are beginning to say, we can't go on like this. It's not rational. It's not plausible. You know, if we turn over well over half of our resources to the aggregate of defense spending, I mean, two journalists with the they were financial journalists with the National Journal said that the cost of killing Osama bin Laden ultimately was $13 trillion. We can't spend money like that and have anything left over in order to meet the human needs at home and abroad.
And I think that women activists are important in reminding folks of the humanity of others. Oftentimes, we think in very small boxes about who we consider their lives being important. And even in America, we have this inability to look at the poor, to look at people who need more than what they're getting as human and as being equal to us and having the same kinds of dreams and desires. And pushing beyond national boundaries is something that Americans have a hard time doing in considering others' humanity. So I think the work of women activists has always been to remind us that we are all alike, that we have more in common than we have that separates us. And so I think that that kind of work over and over and over again is essential.
I want to thank all of you for being on the program today. Blair Kelly, Associate Professor of History at North Carolina State University, author of Right to Ride, Street Boycotts and African-American Citizenship in the Era of Plessy versus Ferguson. Frances Hosso is an Associate Professor in the Women's Studies Program and International Comparative Studies Program at Duke University. Kathy Kelly is an activist and author, three-time Nobel Peace Prize nominee, recently back from Afghanistan, and she will be speaking tonight in Chapel Hill.
Thank you.
Thank you all for being on the program. Up next, a Marine who dedicated his life to helping the people in the Kibera slum of Kenya, Rai Barkat, next on The State of Things. Stay tuned.